You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. December 1991 introduced us to a phenomena that has become one of the most fascinating Fortean topics in the modern era. When a new reporter got handed a lead about a monster running around a road near the town of Elkhorn, both Linda Godfrey and the Dogman became synonymous with each other. Joining me to look back at Linda's legacy and the Dogman conundrum is our good friend Chad Lewis. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to my new supporters, Lex, Autumn, and Amy. Thank you for joining the team. And thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and Mysteries and Monsters with your contributions each month. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Before I and Chad dive into the Dogman phenomena, I'd like to refer to part of the introduction from Linda's book, The Beast of Bray Road. I readily admit my biases, but I try to live by the credo of an old poster that I once had that said, "The mind is like a parachute. It functions best when open." And when it comes to the Dogman, I think we could all do with learning a bit more like that. It's late December 1991, and a new reporter for a local newspaper gets handed a lead that would change her life forever. Over 30 years on, the birth of the Dogman mythos can be traced to that lead that introduced all of us to both Linda Godfrey and the Beast of Bray Road. Joining me on the hunt for the American Dogman is our good friend, Chad Lewis. Chad, welcome!
I'm so glad to be back for my 100th appearance on Mysteries and Monsters podcast.
I'm going to have to start getting some certificates printed, I think, Chad, for returning guests such of your ilk.
Yeah, where's like the Saturday Night Live, like a big robe? I want that velvet robe, like the 9-time, 10-timers club or something.
Yeah, I might stretch to a shower curtain or something like that.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Oh, so obviously it's first time we've spoken for just over 6 months, Chad. How are you? How's things been? How's the winter treating you up there in the north?
I'm doing great. I'm here in Wisconsin in the U.S., which winter no longer exists. It has been banished. We're in a continual spring this winter or fall, depending on what you want to say. We've outlawed snow here in Wisconsin. We have no snow, so things are going great here.
How unusual is it, Chad? Because I know when we've spoken before, and obviously sometimes when I see you winding people up in regards to small flurries that they consider large snowfalls in their particular state, how unusual is it for it to be so free of snow for you guys?
Well, this was one of the first years that I can recall in my lifespan where there really wasn't any snow whatsoever. All the way up through Christmas, all of December, and then we got hit a little bit, and it just melts right away. I know climate's been changing here in Wisconsin quite a bit, where we're much warmer, 3 to 4 degrees over the last 30 to 40 years on average, and a lot less snowfall, but it seems to be very dramatic, where you know, 50 years from now, Wisconsin might be the kind of hotbed for summer and winter vacations. Might be the Miami of the North.
Well, who knows? Stranger thing, it depends on how much those sea levels rise, Chad. You might be the only state left.
That might be right. I mean, we think of climate changes as being an extremely slow where I'm thinking 50 years from now, I might see a woolly mammoth walking back through Wisconsin like they had done before. It might be the new ice age. Things seem to be happening very quickly. So I've got my trail cam set up just in case that's happening.
Yeah. Well, strangely enough, I was watching something the other day where they're saying that that genetics company, they're planning to do their first mammoth births this year.
Oh, wow. That's strange.
Which I can't quite get my head around, Chad, I have to say.
Yeah, that's something out of a sci-fi movie of them bringing back these species. And I know we can bring back quite a few that have gone extinct. And I think it's a fun debate amongst ethicists of whether we should bring them back.
Mm, yeah.
You know, but something like the mammoth, who knows what might come back with that?
Well, this is the other thing. I think often you can bring something back. I mean, I doubt anybody. Well, you never know these days, Chad, what goes on in laboratories. I hope nobody's planning on working on some saber-toothed tigers whilst all this is going on. Because it just seems they're one of these creatures, like the Tasmanian tiger. And I know there's people working on the dodo as well. And it seems that they've got this kind of theory that they want to try and bring things back that they think we're responsible for getting rid of. Now, I'm not saying that we weren't, but where do you draw the line? How many different species are we going to go? Why, as with anything, Chad, I think once they start, I don't think they're going to stop.
Yeah, I'll be real curious to see the effects on the ecosystem of just what it may cause further species to go extinct, bringing back some top line predator. Who knows the effects?
Absolutely. Very much so. I mean, it's one of those things they've said, oh, yeah, we're going to put them in this park in Siberia, as though the mammoths are going to go, oh, yo, OK, we can only stay here and not wander off into Finland or something.
What's interesting is when you read a lot of old history books, you'll often hear of people writing letters home and they'll always say, what a glorious and entertaining, you know, time that we live in. And we can say that now, I think, that we're living in some really strange and interesting times.
Yes, certainly. Well, I think, you know, as we're talking about strange things, we're here today to talk about both the incredible work that Linda Godfrey did throughout her career and the Dogman, which is one of those cryptids, creatures, paranormal entities, whatever you want to sort of pigeonhole as, Chad, that seems to have really come from nowhere, I think, over the last 30 years to become probably one of the top dogs in the world of cryptos.
Really has, and it's remarkable. I was just thinking the other day I was doing a lot of historical research on really old legends that people have forgotten of. And I, you know, kind of just made note to myself that it's interesting because we look at all these legends, but they were new at some point, somewhere along the line, they were new. And I was thinking, we don't have as many new legends as it seems like they did in the old days. And because a lot of these are digital legends of Slender Man and the like, where everyone knows that they, quote unquote, are not real. But I love these stories of like Chupacabra that's relatively new and all these other cryptids. And I think Dogman would fit into that category where just even 20 years ago, you didn't hear of it as much as today at all. Mm. And today, as you're right, it seems to be, you know, right up there with Bigfoot in terms of what people are interested in.
Yeah. It's one of those things I can't place when I first became aware of it, Chad. But I know I've known about it, like you say, for at least 20 years. And I'm thinking, did I see it mentioned in the 14 times in the late 90s, perhaps? Or did I see it on a cable TV show in a little segment at some point, or like Unsolved Mysteries or something? It's one of those that, even though I know it's a fairly recent one, when you look at it, it feels like it's always been with us, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think part of that is then, once we get these legends, we go back in time and try to find other cases that might fit into them, that something somebody might have explained as a sighting of a werewolf, Bigfoot, just unknown creature, some what's it, and maybe it fits into what we now think of as Dogman. So we start building this predated history of it, and that tends to give it this longer life feel that it's been around since, you know, non-Indigenous people came here.
I mean, for you, Chad, obviously living in Wisconsin, the Dogman, it's basically ground zero for its whole creation and the way it's spread from that particular state all the way around the world now, even to the reports that people are making in Europe these days, which is even stranger. So even with your interest in the weird and the wonderful, was this something that you were aware of back in the 90s, Chad, or is it something that, as you've continued to build your reputation and your research, you've kind of come to it later?
Certainly it would be more recent than a lot of the other things that I've researched. Now, I first met Linda Godfrey back in 2003, and it must have been January-ish, because her first book, The Poison Whittle, had just come out. This was prior to her publishing The Beast of Bray Road, which came out in 2003 as well.
Mm.
And it was prior to that when she took me around Bray Road and gave me a tour of places. And at that point, we were all just talking werewolves.
Yeah.
That the distinction of there being something other than that wasn't very prevalent back then. In fact, I can't even remember in the early days, Linda and I ever discussing what might be a difference between a dog man and a werewolf. So I think that came with me, like everybody else, when Linda started getting these reports. And then once she published some of her books, then they came flooding in from everywhere.
I think it does strike. I think one of the strangest things about all this is that obviously Bray Road, with the greatest of respect, is a very nondescript stretch of tarmac, really. It's not a major thoroughfare. It simply cuts through pretty rural farmland. It seems to be one of those places that, whilst it's a road that's used to connect other places, it seems to be one of those that doesn't get a lot of traffic. And so it seems to be one of those places where, I don't know whether it's the quietness of a stretch of road like that, Chad, that seems to attract weirdness to it.
It is. It's one of those places. It's about 4 or 5 miles long, and it connects several busier roads, and you kind of use it just to cut through or cut over. Nobody's just traveling down it to get somewhere unless you live on that road. But otherwise, you're just cutting across it. And a lot of people contact me, and they're very disappointed in Bray Road when they first go there, because in their mind, it's been built up so much that they're expecting this crepid road, you know, maybe gravel way out in the boondocks where nobody's inhabiting. And Bray Road's like any other road, I think, in terms of look. Feel might be a little bit different, but in terms of the picture of it, it's like any back farm road you might have turned on if you're taking the back roads and your GPS is bringing you somewhere. That there are a few farms on the road. There's several houses dotting the landscape. There's some people raising small livestock, and nothing out of the ordinary at first glance. But even though people contact me and say they're disappointed in the overall look and feel of it, they also believe that there's something not quite right about it.
Is it something that in your career over the last 20 years, Chad, you've had people come to you with experiences in regards to these kind of encounters? Or is it, as you were saying there, with your meeting of Linda 20 years ago and building up that relationship, that you got involved in investigating some of them? Or is it you've found some in other places that you've then tracked down and kind of liaised with Linda in regards to her research that she was doing during that period?
Luckily for me, I spend a great deal of time lecturing throughout the Midwest during the year. I mean, pre and post COVID, I'd be doing maybe 200 lectures throughout the Midwest at libraries, historical societies, colleges, and the like. So that affords me the opportunity to interact with a lot of the general public. Most people that come to my programs are not diehard researchers. They're just the general public who might be interested in these things, or somebody who's had an experience. So I would get to collect a lot of these legends and lore from around the Midwest of people who had seen similar things. And Linda and myself and many other investigators would call one another and say, I just heard about this place. Have you ever heard anything on this? Or oftentimes, you know, she'd call and ask if I have a haunted story from this place, because I'd maybe written about it in a haunted book. And that was another big surprise, that when I started getting these reports of werewolves or dogmen, that often they would occur in supernatural hotbeds. These, you know, John Keel would call them window areas, these portals, if you will, these beacons, where there may be tons of UFO sightings or a lot of haunted ghost stories from a specific area. And then all of a sudden people start seeing a werewolf or a dog man lurking about. And that was always what fascinated me, the connection, or maybe not the connection, between these things at these places.
I suppose as well, because of everything that's gone on in regards to this, as you say, I'm often surprised when people have been there and they say they're disappointed. Once again, it seems to be one of those phenomena that people expect to have an encounter, Chad, which I find quite puzzling, because one of the wonderful things and frustrating things about such encounters and such witnesses is that often these accounts are sporadic. There doesn't seem to be any pattern to them. There seems to be a variety of times of year and in the day, often at night as well, where you can't sort of pencil it in and say, well, this is the prime time for an encounter. And so do you think, through your research, do you think that's something that's just built up, that people seem to think there's a lot more going on down that particular stretch of road than there really is? I mean, there's still plenty of reports, but still, it seems that some people seem to think it's Werewolf Central.
That's great. Werewolf Central. I need that on a shirt. Yeah, you're right. I think people, that's why, as I just mentioned, of people being kind of disappointed when they visit, is I really think that not only with the Beast of Bray Road, but a lot of these other, let's say, legends that have a lot of PR behind them, a lot of media exposure behind them, people think it's Disneyland, where you just go there and things are going to pop out. It's going to happen because you've heard so much about it that it has to occur every single time. So I think people that maybe just breeze through the road or spend an hour there a night and then forget about it, you know, they're disappointed that nothing happens. But I've learned in this field that outside of people who believe that dares, taking a supernatural dare, that if you knock on a mausoleum at midnight, you know, the ghost of the man buried in there will come out. Outside of those specific dares, there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason or calendar. It's as though these supernatural anomalies are not punching a time card or keeping a calendar of when they have to appear or not appear. So I think oftentimes it's just sheer being in the right place or the wrong place at the right time, that the overwhelming majority of people that I hear from that have had an experience with something, it's not caused by them actively looking for it. They're driving home from work, or they're out on a hike, they're minding their own business, doing something else, when all of a sudden something bizarre happens to them, rather than, you know, somebody with their camera and their gear out in a specific area trying to document something. So that's a puzzling too, that it seems to be the less you look for it, the more likely you might find it.
I suppose the whole aspect of this that I've never really kind of understood is that for a lot of these witnesses that have encounters and have reported them over the years, there's this kind of play that seems to go on. That I know one of the early encounters, one of the young ladies who made the first reports, the one who thought that she'd run over something and got out of a car to check, and she just said, and then I saw this thing running towards her, is that there's a lot of this that when we're talking about a creature, and when we discuss wild animals in general, Chad, the vast majority of large predators, bears and wolves, can chase a human down in next to no time at all. And a lot of this seems to be whatever this creature is that these people are reporting, there's this, it knows what it can do, and it wants that person to realize just how scared they should be, but it's going to let them get away. Just
a lot of people contact me and say that when I'm speaking with them, they say it's like they walked into a zone of fear, or they were trapped in this zone of irrational fear. And not as though you're out hiking and you run into a moose or a black bear, which can be very scary, but it's something out of the ordinary. And a lot of people, even though they're in the presumed safety of a vehicle, that they could hightail it out of there as fast as they wanted and be in safety, they feel as though that their life's in danger, that there's this unnatural fear that if they don't get out of the area, something terrible is going to happen. Almost like a foretelling of ill fate. And then once they get out of the area, or the zone, if you will, they get home, they calm down, they feel a little embarrassed and shy about how over the top frightened they became. At that moment, they truly believe that this thing is out to get them, even though there's no menacing charging. You know, it's not like a grizzly charging at you, or there's no other signs of aggression outside of just looking terrifying. So I'm always puzzled by that, too, that whatever these things are, it seems that fear accompanies them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the key sighting that occurred with that one, I think, is the Doris Gibson encounter, which I know some people have dismissed because the first time she saw it was on Halloween. And this is one of those explanations, Chad, that when you think about it, it doesn't really make sense, especially when you know the location and you think, well, with the greatest respect, who's going to be sat about at 2 a.m. dressed as a werewolf hoping some woman drives past?
Of course, skeptics claim that all the time. And I've heard that for so many different cryptids, especially, that I've heard from numerous people that all claim to be the origin of a certain legend. And not realizing that there have been stories dating back a very long time. But another thing this brings up is the absurdity of some of these sightings. There's an interesting case down in Iowa, right outside of Fort Dodge, which is a fairly large town. There's this tiny little disappearing town called Terra. And the locals have a bridge there that they call Terror Bridge, T-E-R-R-O-R. And they claim that it's haunted by a railroad worker and a woman who disposed of her children on an oncoming train, and on and on and on. But that's why most people go out there. But I spoke with a group of teenagers, this one woman who was telling me that she had an encounter as a teenager when her and her friends went out there to see the ghosts. And again, this comes back to the window area. So they're out there looking for ghost encounters and on the bridge, parking their car, and the woman's supposed to throw you off the bridge to your own death. But nothing happened. But as they were leaving, she said they noticed this werewolf-type creature running on two legs next to them. And the driver was so terrified that the driver was going about 60 miles per hour on this gravel back roads road, very fast on a gravel road. And the witness told me that the thing kept up with them and that no matter how fast they went, until finally it was just gone. It didn't slow down. It didn't lose steam. It was just wasn't there. But she said, I don't want to tell you this next part because you're going to think I'm crazy, which, of course, to me, gets me all excited thinking, oh, great, this is going to be wonderful. She said the weird thing about the stereotypical werewolf creature that she had spotted running was that it was wearing a plaid sports jacket, like a professor might wear, with the elbow patches and everything that you might see out of a movie if someone's trying to portray a professor in an Ivy League school, that the werewolf or whatever it was wearing that. And that made her not want to report it. And we find so many times that these sightings, all up to a point, seem very believable. And then all of a sudden there's that one little thing that sets it aside, that I don't know the reasoning for it. I don't know why it is, but it just becomes absurd that it would be wearing a sport jacket around.
I know that there have been reports of people having encounters with Bigfoot and Sasquatch, where not many, but there are reports of them, what they seem to think that they're wearing clothing of some kind, Chad, and it makes you wonder. Obviously, this is slightly different in regards to dogman and werewolves, really, because for a lot of people, when you have the differential between them, werewolves are supposed to be humans that transform into a creature, and therefore the possibility of something still wearing clothes, as we mentioned from many a horror film, the amount of werewolves that manage to keep their trousers on in the 40s and 50s is quite remarkable, Chad. a bit like the Hulk. And so that seems to be more plausible when we're talking about incredible encounters with strange creatures than you would suggest seeing a Bigfoot wearing a shirt or something. And then you begin to think, well, did they get that from somebody else? And they just took a shine to it.
Puzzling questions. And you're right that if we believe one of the main differences between a werewolf and a dogman would be that werewolves transform. They're human most of the time and they transform, whether the full moon or traditionally werewolves were most prevalent and most active and most likely to transform during the 12 days of Christmas. There are so many old newspaper accounts saying that's the time you had to be the most worried about a werewolf, not necessarily the full moon, but the 12 days of Christmas, which run from you know, December 25th through January 6th of the Epiphany. That was when you had to be scared by these creatures. So I think it's fascinating that the idea that if you do transform, yeah, you would have maybe this one kept its sport coat, but lost its trousers somehow, or its shoes or socks or, you know, boxers, whatever. But with Dogman, it doesn't seem to fit unless they find discarded objects and decide, oh, this might keep me warm.
I mean, this is one of those things, as I was speaking with your good friend and colleague Steve Ward recently, we were on about the whole emphasis that Keel had about making sure that he knew everything about a witness, even down to what they'd had for breakfast on the day of their particular experience, Chad. And I think, as you mentioned there will be encounters and experiences that witnesses have where there seems to be this line of weirdness that they could be talking about something fantastical, and then they'll say, well, I can't tell you about that thing because that's too weird. You know, as the famous case of the space pancakes and other such ones like that, or the Hopkinsville goblins, they seem to be so strange that they take them into a different direction, and certain researchers will just go, no, I'm not interested now.
Well, that was certainly the case with Joe Simonton with the UFO pancakes in Eagle River, Wisconsin, when he has the sighting of a craft landing in his yard while he's having a late breakfast, and he walks out and encounters several of the inhabitants or the aliens, the pilot, the human, whatever it was. And, you know, they need water. They have a jug. He fills up the jug and goes back. Now, that's the end of the story. That's, you could see that they need water. Who knows why? That's believable. But the part off Project Blue Book and Dr. J. Allen Hynek came up with two graduate students from the university in Illinois to investigate it was the fact that once Simonton gave the jug of water, the beings traded him several of these alien pancake-like things for exchange for the water. And then they flew off, and Simonton ate one of the pancakes, and he said it was the worst tasting thing he'd ever had. He said, no wonder they're so small. If this is what they're eating, I feel sorry for them. And that's at a point where you think, okay, now you're really stretching believability here.
Yeah.
But I've learned long ago, when you're dealing with the weird, what is too weird?
Yeah.
Where do you draw that line? Because so many researchers, at least in the early days, two decades ago and beyond, that if it was that weird, nope, I want nothing to do with it. And Hynek was the same way in the beginning, that if there was an encounter of a being of some sort, that was just too weird to be true. Don't even need to investigate it. Don't go. UFO sighting, great, but encounter with something on board? There's no reason. Why are you wasting your time? It didn't happen. So that's changed quite a bit in the last few decades as well, where that I think a lot more researchers, if they get a report of, let's say, a UFO, they also inquire about what's going on in the witness's life, if they've encountered ghost stories or had any other weird synchronicities or anything, because so many of us now are looking at maybe the interconnectedness of these things.
I think it's good to have that kind of open-mindedness, because it's something I'll be the first to admit, before I started doing the show, Chad, I would have had that line, that if you went over that line, I'm like, no, I'm not going with you. I don't care how good the story is up till this point, you've lost me already. Whereas now I've heard so many things and read so much and heard from people in a variety of 14 fields, from experiences to researchers, that I realized that there's a lot more to some of this stuff than meets the first glance at it. And I think if we are true lovers of the weird and the Fortean, then we have to sort of look in ourselves to find, why do we believe something is too weird to verify it for some reason?
I would have a line of too weird. I would have missed out on a lot of really cool stories, and may have told this story on one of my previous 100 appearances on the show. But it was after a program where a gentleman came up to me and said, you have to come up to my land. I have some Bigfoot creatures on the property. And this was about 9 p.m. It was at a conference. I had a few other researchers with me, and we said, great, we'd love to go. We can go right after this. And he said, oh, you probably won't see them, though. And inquired why, and he said, oh, because they're in a different dimension, but I can still see them. So we still thought, perfect, it's still well worth the chance. I mean, how often you get to visit with interdimensional Bigfoot creatures. But as he kept going on, he said, well, you know, they're probably busy. They do similar things like we do. They have a pool party and a barbecue, and they're hanging out in their dimension. And at that time, you know, again, this is probably way out there, you're thinking in your mind, but a possibility of, wow, what if it's not?
Mm.
So I always, no matter how far-fetched it may seem, how bizarre, and yes, we did go with the guy, and we never did see that Bigfoot barbecue, but again, just closing yourself off is, where do you draw that line? And I think sometimes if you draw that line, you're going to miss out on a lot of legends that maybe, again, chupacabras are too weird for you, or Wendigos too bizarre, vampires. And sometimes you find that the more bizarre it is, for me, the more interesting it becomes.
I suppose as well, one of the interesting aspects to the whole Dogman phenomenon is that it was clearly one of those cases that simply needed exposure, Chad, I think, because obviously in the 30 years since this all started back in Elkhorn, it suddenly realized that there were lots of these stories that were kind of buried away in the past in newspapers and old books that, once again, I think people had overlooked because they were like, well, these people are talking about werewolves and that can't be real.
I find that quite a bit, especially with old newspaper accounts, and obviously even predating Bigfoot being known, or the word Bigfoot, you'd have the wild men of the woods or the wild man, usually a disheveled looking creature, but oftentimes they were described as large ape or large dog-like creatures. They didn't have the terminology of it. They didn't have the knowing of it. But so that's what when I mentioned earlier about how we can go back in time and do kind of archaeology of these stories, that's a lot of fun, that you start digging up these stories and you say, wait, could they have been describing a dog man here, but just didn't know what the heck it really was? And I love surfing through and sifting through, I guess, a lot of these old newspaper archives just to try to find those rare gems.
Yeah. I think as well, the aspect of all this is that before Linda kind of grabbed this story by its hair and dragged it into the light, was that there were clearly things going on, because there was a song that had been written in the 80s, I believe, about, and then obviously you've got the famous incident where Linda goes to see the local forestry and game chap, and he'd got a big file that said werewolf on it. So despite the fact that she'd only spoken to those two ladies, there were people seeing something, Chad, and it had been going on for quite a while. Then do you think it is simply the fact that, despite small town America and the fact that there will be strange things going on with, you know, as we mentioned, Mothman or Van Meter, Momo, you've got, you know, Lake Worth Monster, there are these cases all around North America where something strange is happening in a small town, and it seems to become ingrained in that town's history. And yet here, do you think it was because people thought they were seeing some kind of werewolf dogman creature that they just didn't want it to get out, as it were?
Yeah, I believe so. I think, remember, this was pre-internet of the time as well, when Linda first started receiving reports, 1990-1991-ish. And at that time, you know, her kid, one of her children was in school and would ride the bus and would hear from the friends that they would be talking about it, because much like a lot of legends, you know, young teenagers and younger, they're kind of the first to know about these legends, to talk about it. And that's where they spread. And Linda loved telling the story of going to the DNR, asking about these legends. And it was like a scene out of the X-Files where the officer comes out with a folder marked werewolf on it and plops it down in front of her. It's something out of a movie. And a lot of people don't realize that when Linda first started researching these cases, she was more on the skeptical side of, no, this can't be right. This isn't happening here. But I think over the years, the evidence and the witnesses really convinced her that something was going on. But at the time, even to today, Walworth County and Elkhorn, the city where Bray Road is, they don't promote it at all. You can't go there and get a Beast of Bray Road bumper sticker, t-shirt. I mean, it's make it the exact opposite of Roswell. Where you go to Roswell in New Mexico, you go to the museum, you go to the McDonald's, they have a UFO out in front. I mean, it's everywhere. They do such a great job. Or Mothman in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. But you go to Elkhorn and you think, am I in the wrong place? There's nothing here to see about the legend.
Well, I suppose as well, it's one of those things that, as you mentioned there, do you think it's because of the setting that it's probably not the best place to build some kind of museum or something? Or do you think it's one of those where, that unlike some of the other areas that we've covered previously, Chad, they're still trying to keep it at arm's length, even though, once again, people around the world know the name Elkhorn for one reason?
I'm not sure. Now, I think they've done a terrible job of promoting it, because a visitor is a visitor, whether they're there to see your old bridge or your old werewolf.
Yes.
And I love telling the story that in the early days, I remember riding around with Linda in her vehicle, and she had personalized license plates that said like Bray Road or Bray Beast or Beast Bray, abbreviated on there. And she said, oh yeah, I put those on because I really want to spread the legend. People should know about this, such a cool case. And then after a couple of years, she said, Chad, I'm getting rid of those. Too much attention. Everywhere I drive, people know they're honking, they're pointing on the road. So she got rid of the person. I think they're in Lauren Coleman's International Cryptozoology Museum now,
yeah,
the license plates. But I thought that was funny that, you know, she kind of took it upon herself to promote this legend, because there was no Dogman Days or Werewolf Weekend, any of that that the town was sponsoring. I think you're right that because it happens on kind of a outskirts of town, that might add some difficulty to promoting it in town, because that's the only place you could have it, is a festival downtown or at a, you know, a banquet hall or something like that. But then you have to drive 5 miles out into the road to experience it. So I think that lends itself to not being a typical tourist draw, because so many people just travel down Bray Road and that's it. They're out of the area. They leave. They're not stopping. So I think that's unfortunate, but more and more people are taking advantage of it. There's a resident that lives on Bray Road that has constructed a huge wood carving of a werewolf, very lifelike looking. And it's, you know, 8 feet tall, but dressed as a werewolf, looks like a convincing werewolf, but he has it chained up. So it looks like it's chained to the ground, like it's going to come after you if it busts those chains. So a lot of people will pull over and snap photos with it and that.
Well, I suppose as well, as we know, there seems to be a story every year where somebody's Bigfoot statue gets stolen. Chad, I suppose there's also that aspect to it.
Exactly. I think it's a lot of fun. I really wish, part of me really wishes that they would do something to promote it, because when I go there, I would love to pop in and grab a shirt or something. But also there's that skeptic out there saying, oh, they're trying to make a buck off this. Of course they believe the legend, or of course they're going to promote it. It's all about getting tourists. And I think the idea that they're not doing it adds a little more credibility, even though I think every community that has a bizarre legend should promote the heck out of it. It's the same as if you found gold in your river, you wouldn't just leave it there and say, I don't want to take advantage of this gold. So I always look at communities that do promote it as being smart about it. I don't think it lessens the credibility. I think even if they don't believe the legend, like a lot of people in Van Meter, Iowa, the small town where the Van Meter visitor has been spotted, this giant bat-like creature, are skeptics. They say, I don't think this ever happened. I don't believe it for one instant, but you know what? I'm going to the festival. I think it's a great legend for our community. So belief doesn't have to tie itself with interest.
Well, I think that was always one of the key aspects of Linda's work as well, because obviously one of the most famous incidents tied up in all this is the Gable film, Chad. And if people are going to accept anything that creates publicity, as the old adage goes, there's no such thing as bad publicity, then surely people wouldn't have tried to forensically examine the history of this film. And Linda, along with a couple of other people, really dug that film to pieces and found out that it was a very well constructed hoax, but it was a hoax nonetheless, because it seemed once again somebody tried to take advantage of it and probably wasn't prepared for how much publicity actually garnered, because they just seemed to, as soon as the heat was on, they went, actually, well, no, this isn't real.
I think that happens quite a bit, that hoaxes that people think will be fun or they're just doing it sometimes get out of hand very quickly or really drift out of control. And that was one. I did a book on a creature called the Big Muddy Monster, a 1-foot-like creature down in southern Illinois by the Big Muddy River. And I heard from a gentleman who said, oh, my buddy was there. He was the one. He had created some stink juice, he called it, this weird, terrible smelling perfume like that he poured on himself. And again, waited out in the woods at 11 p.m. on a random weekday, hoping that somebody would just show up and they could scare them. But that the reason they never came forward is they thought there was going to be charges, because the couple that did witness it went right down to the law enforcement office about midnight, and the officers came back, and it was a big to do. And for the next several nights, they were called out all over the town. The entire force was on alert for this Bigfoot type creature. And the person was afraid that if they ever came forward, even 30 some years, 40 some years now, that they would be in a lot of trouble. And I actually started digging around with law enforcement in that area, who said they wouldn't have been in trouble at that time. You know, they might have gotten a disorderly conduct or something, but it certainly wouldn't have been a big issue if they said, oh, I just made up this story. So the idea that people hoax it and it just gets out of control is one I put up there, right up with the Scooby-Doo explanation of that somebody created this story to keep them away from their farmland, or that kids were going out to this abandoned area on the farm and partying. So the owner came up with this great idea of having a giant Bigfoot-like creature, not realizing that that only works in Scooby-Doo, that here in the real world, that attracts more people.
And obviously, as well, you've got to be very careful if you're going to pretend to be a cryptid, because we obviously had that incident, I don't know, was it 10 years ago, where that chap was pretending to be Bigfoot who unfortunately found himself getting run over?
That's right. That was out west, I think, here in the U.S. But that happens, and it defies logic that a lot of these places are gun country.
Yes.
Where people are hunting, they're carrying guns. So back to the Big Muddy Monster, when back in about 5-6 years ago, when I was down there interviewing some of the witnesses and some of the police officers and the like that were involved back in, you know, 1973 and 74, that they were armed when I interviewed them. So people were walking around with weapons, and it's gun country, that nobody would be running around in a costume trying to make a prank and risk getting shot at. Oh, I shouldn't say nobody, because we know it happens, as you alluded to, the gentleman who got hit on the side of the road dressing up. So, but I think for the most part, those of us with common sense would probably not go out in gun country dressed up as an unknown creature.
Well, that's one of the aspects of all this I always have to agree with when it comes to things like that, Chad, because with the greatest respect, I know some people have said, oh, well, if they think it's a misidentified bear, it might not have been bear season. That's why they've not shot it. And I find that odd, because I've seen some witnesses who have had encounters with dogmen who have very similar reactions to the same as when certain hunters have seen Bigfoot, and they've looked down the scope and they can tell exactly what they know, what it isn't, straight away. And often they say that they can't pull the trigger for whatever reason. Now, with the greatest of respect, there will be some people out there who, if they see something like this, they're going to go. They're going to shoot it. And I don't find that a plausible explanation to say that these are people running about in costumes, because somebody's going to get killed. And I find it incredible that it hasn't happened yet. Thankfully, one would say.
I agree, too, especially when you think of skeptics claiming that almost all of these things were put on by hoaxes, all well-known cryptids that were all hoaxed either knowingly by the witness or the witness was hoaxed by it, that you would think just out of dumb luck, somebody would have blasted. And there are times when people do blast at these monsters, like the Van Meter Visitor. Townsfolk shot at it night after night. The Enfield Horror, where Mr. McDaniel down in Enfield, Illinois, came out and saw this, you know, kangaroo looking thing on his front porch, blasted it a couple times, was certain he hit it. Hopkinsville Goblins. They were certain they'd hit it. Fault Monster. Again, all over and over and over, people believe that they've struck this thing with her weapons, but yet it's seemingly impervious to those weapons or has little to no effect.
Yeah, that is one of the key aspects of some of these encounters, especially, I know, with Folk. You know, that's been shot at several times and seems to be okay. I know one of the witnesses said he'd hit it with sort of a very junior issue ammunition, which really would just give somebody a bit of a nasty bruise more than anything, Chad. But it is remarkable. I mean, like Hopkinsville is a prime example of people being dismissed completely out of hand, because I've heard over the last few years a particularly well-known skeptic say that he's heard it off the record, which always makes me chuckle that when somebody official gives an off-the-record explanation, we're supposed to believe that, even though there's no evidence that that person said that. They, for all we know, and they probably did based on this, was that everybody in that house was drunk. And I find that remarkable, that if they were so drunk, why was nobody injured? I find that ridiculous.
Nobody was shot at. And I can tell you, growing up in Wisconsin, I've had a few nights where I've, you know, taken down a lining kugels or two here. And no matter how many lining kugels I've had, I've never thought there was a werewolf or a UFO alien in my backyard. You know, so whatever they're drinking, even if they're all intoxicated, there must be some powerful moonshine, because they're coming up with just the craziest things. Now, you might think the drinking would skew a bit of their memory or fuzzy details. Yes, I get that completely. But the idea that all of a sudden you're seeing a, you know, 9-foot vegetable man like thing in your backyard from a couple, you know, spirits, I don't know. It just doesn't ring true to me. But then again, you know, I've often looked at, I had a colleague that really liked to deal with haunted stories. So he would go to a lot of people that have had experiences at their home. They thought their home may be haunted. And every time he'd show up, you know, nothing would happen, over and over and over. And then he'd leave and the family would call and say, oh, no, this is happening. So eventually he got to the point where he'd show up, set up a few pieces of equipment, and then almost pretend he was part of the family. If they were playing a board game, he'd hop in with it. If they were sitting around having a few cocktails with cards, playing cards, he would do the same thing and seeing if that helped out. And perhaps it is something about alcohol or spirits that allows you to experience these things. I'm not certain.
Yeah, I'm going to say, you know, I'm quite partial to a few drinks on a weekend, Chad. And I've, sadly, the only time I ever saw anything, I was cold and sober. So, you know, when I saw my strange thing in the sky, I hadn't had a drink in the slightest. And you know, I've been drunk more than I should have done in regards to being able to see something. And I've never seen anything odd, ever. You know, and I used to run bars. So I never had one of my customers come in and claim to have been abducted on the way home from a heavy Friday night, Chad, either.
And I think it just exposes that sometimes we're so desperate to look for an explanation on both sides, yes, whether it's a very strange explanation or a mundane, that we often lend ourselves to thinking that it could be one thing or another. But when you start to dive deep into those explanations, they seem more far-fetched than the actuality of it being something unknown.
Mm. Yeah, very much. And I think often we kind of point the fingers at some of the skeptical explanations without sort of doing the same on the other side, that sometimes people, as we were saying earlier about how strange is strange, that some people will try and tailor a witness's encounter into what they want it to be, rather than actually, once again, listening to what the witness has said. And you can see this in regards to Dogman. I've seen people try and say that the witnesses are mistaken and what they've seen is a Bigfoot, when they're clearly not describing a Bigfoot. They're describing a bipedal dog creature.
This happens all the time, and not just with Bigfoot. The same with Bigfoot and Wendigo. Mm. You get a lot of people who say, were they just seeing a Bigfoot and they thought it was a Wendigo? And then when you look at the actual witness account of this thing, you know, being 8 feet tall, skeletal, thin, emaciated, skin pulled tight over its body, looking more like a walking skeleton, you're thinking it's probably a difficult thing to confuse with anything else. That's something that, you know, you're not going to confuse that from a white-tailed deer with something else. So a lot of times these are very strange. And I think partly because some of these sightings, whether they're creatures, ghosts, what be it, are often fleeting. As I mentioned before, most of the people that contact me, they weren't out looking for it. So when it happens, it's not as though they watched a Bigfoot moving around for 30 minutes. It's something big passed in front of them in their vehicle, through the lights, crossed the road in a couple gigantic steps, and it was gone. So oftentimes, sometimes when we really pick apart werewolves and dogmen and look at some of the differences, sometimes the people just saw something bizarre and they didn't get a close enough look to see if its hands were more human-like or dog-like versus just seeing this big hairy thing move across the road.
Well, I know. I think there's one of the encounters that Linda covers in the Beast of Bray Road book where a chap, I think he was driving along and he hit something. He thought he'd run over a letterbox. He thought he'd gone off the road and hit something. And then he reversed the car and realized he came face to face with what it was. And he was so frightened, he told the police about it, Chad. So he then began to think, well, if a young person's going to go and see the authorities and tell them this incredible tale, first thing they're probably going to do is breathalyze them to make sure they're not intoxicated or driving under the influence of anything else. And also the fact that they've got to put their name to that statement that they're making to the officers. So, and they said, oh yeah, it was a bear. But when he was asked about it, he said, it definitely wasn't a bear. I just couldn't describe anything that looked like it other than a bear, but it wasn't a bear.
The same thing happened another case here in Wisconsin where a county worker whose job was to go around picking up carcasses of roadkill.
Yes.
And it was early morning and he's driving around. He sees something new on the side of the road. It wasn't on his chart of what to pick up, which meant it had been recently hit. And he gets out, has his lights flashing, it's dark, his music going, and he throws it in the back of the pickup truck. It was a small deer. He didn't need the ramp. And as he's doing the paperwork, he feels the truck shake and thinks nothing of it. The wind shakes a little bit more and looks back and sees this giant paw of this creature or something pull the deer carcass out of the back of the truck along with the ramps. And then he sped off. He was terrified. Went down to law enforcement immediately and made the report. And they came back and the ramps were gone. The creature was gone. But he actually did it because he felt if this thing was brave enough to steal something out of the back of his truck, what else was it capable of? And he had mentioned it looked kind of like a bear mixed with a wolf, a bear wolf. And of course, the media ran with it as a Bigfoot. And he never mentioned in his report of Bigfoot at all. But I mean, that's kind of the thing most people are aware of. So it's the closest thing. Let's just call it that. Doesn't matter. The thing doesn't exist in their mind. Who cares if we call it a unicorn?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that once again goes into that people hallucinating when they're too drunk then. Why are we not coming across thousands of people saying they've encountered a unicorn, Chad?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make sense. And I mean, so much of this field is not only speculation, but just unknown. And I think over the years, that's one thing that has changed in my research anyway, is that when I got into this work, I thought, like most people naively, that, oh, this will be interesting. I'll figure this out, find out why this place is haunted and have all kinds of answers. And when that didn't come for me right away, I really shifted early on at looking at these things, more of the folklore of them and what they mean and what they tell us about ourselves as a species or a community, rather than whether or not it actually happened. Because if somebody tells me they're out on Bray Road and they see a werewolf jump on their hood and run off, you know, to them, it really happened, regardless of whether or not what I have to say about it, and vice versa. So oftentimes, it's very difficult to prove or disprove these things. We can only take them at face value and try to compare them with other things, looking for some similarities or correlations of some sort.
Well, yeah, and I know when more modern investigators and teams have turned up looking into this, because obviously now it's become well established, the new explanation seems to be, well, people are seeing wolves, which, fair enough, Wisconsin does have a very healthy wolf population. I know that they, whilst they're, as far as I'm aware, Chad, there's never been a documented attack, on a human that we're aware of, obviously, by a wolf in Wisconsin in the modern era. They have not a sizable population, but it's a very healthy population in regards to some of the northern states in the US. And yet, you only have to look back to like when some of these cases were happening. Wolves were very rarely reported, and anybody who knows anything about wolves knows that they're not the kind of creatures that go looking for people, generally.
A lot of the North Woods of the Midwest and a lot of Canada, and a wolf is one of those creatures I've never seen on a hike or exploring through the woods, and I've actively looked for them. Places where you can hear them, you know they're there, never seen one. So, they're not out looking to chase after every hiker, a person out there. They're minding their own business, going about their own work. So, yeah, these, and again, it'd be very hard pressed to, I think you'd be better chances of confusing a wolf with a dog or a coyote rather than a wolf with a werewolf. I mean, the similarities end at the name wolf.
Yes.
Well, that's the only thing these things share. When you're talking a werewolf or a dog man reports, you know, anywhere from 6, maybe 8 feet tall, bipedal, running upright on their hind legs like you and I do, that they're bipeds, covered in thick, matted down fur, huge muzzle, often sprinting on hind legs, just things you normally wouldn't see a gray wolf or a timber wolf doing on a daily basis.
I think I read somewhere once as well that I think Linda might have done some research into this, that when these reports were coming, people were suggesting that the wolf population in Wisconsin, because they've kind of come into the state naturally, I believe, Chad, from surrounding areas, that even back then, people were saying there was possibly 2 to 3 dozen wolves in the whole state.
And here in Wisconsin, specifically, they're all up north in the northern section with us, whether we're branched off into the upper peninsula of Michigan or over to the north shore of Minnesota or up into Canada as well. And Elkhorn, where Beast of Bray Road has been reported, is in far southeastern Wisconsin. It's about 5 times closer to Milwaukee than it is to wilds of the North Woods. So the idea that the wolves are coming down that far doesn't make a lot of sense at that time. That, yes, we have wolves. We're going to have a lot fewer of them now that hunting them is apparently back on the agenda here in Wisconsin. So, but that's all up in the North Woods. That's not anywhere near Elkhorn. So that idea, again, becomes very far-fetched. And then we can get into the idea of, well, maybe they're escaped circus animals, which seems to be the tried and true, at least back when the circus was the dominant force in America for entertainment. And I always joke that I don't know how these circuses were ever staying in business, because every stop they made, they were losing 2 or 3 animals at a time, according to witnesses. So I find it fascinating how these stories continue to morph and progress, the explanations of them, that, again, in the early 1900s, even the late 1800s, they were circus escapees, that the circus lost them and said, they're not worth, even though they're thousands of dollars, they're not worth going to retrieve. Let's just let them run around. And now it's just mistaken for natural animals, or again, alcohol's the reason. So at some point, I think we should start taking these witnesses for face value, that they believe they saw something, you know, perhaps they did.
I know I've seen people suggest that what the other answer to this conundrum is that people are seeing baboons, Chad. I think primarily because they're probably the only ape species that's kind of got a similar muzzle, you could suggest. Obviously, it's not identical, but it's the only one that seems to have something that could be, as you say, if somebody sees a quick glance of something or whatever, they might mistake it. However, baboons are very noisy creatures, and they're also very territorial, can be extremely aggressive at times. But the other aspect is they don't get bigger than 3.5 feet tall.
It's interesting. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And again, it's just stretching believability that you're going to see something of a baboon size or a chimpanzee or orangutan size, even a silverback gorilla, and mistake it for what some of these witnesses are describing. But here in Wisconsin, I do have to note that we have one of the most lax laws in place about owning exotic animals, where we're one of the best or worst, depending on how you look at it, states for controlling people. If you want to go get a lion, you know, you're welcome to do so in much of Wisconsin. So we do have that. But again, I think the idea that people are just misidentified, and we know through years and years of studying witnesses in courts, the legal system, that we're terrible witnesses overall. Humans are just terrible. But I think there's a difference between being terrible and then mistaking a, you know, baboon for a, you know, 9-foot Bigfoot type creature.
I suppose the big issue as well in all this, Chad, is there is a real bit of contention about this, as I was saying earlier on, because these reports are now being seen around the world, and people are, even here in the UK, there's a spate of sightings of something that Paul Sinclair's done a lot of work in researching. It's interesting that people are trying to suggest that Paul is saying that we have Dogman here. But every time I've spoken with Paul, and I've heard him on other things, he's very careful to say he doesn't believe it's a flesh and blood creature. He thinks there's something supernatural going on with a lot of these reports. But for some people, it seems as though the Dogman now seems to be morphing into the werewolf, Chad. But when you look at what a werewolf traditionally is and what people are reporting in regards to a Dogman, there's a key difference. Do you see that a lot, that it seems to be blurring the lines between Dogman and werewolf these days, or that people are still trying to keep them in two separate camps?
Myself, I see it more as one strange entity, whether you call it and there might be differences. But again, you know, we think of a dogman as being in that form permanently. They're not someone or something that morphs or changes or transforms on certain times or dates, that they remain in that form the entire time. But again, nobody's ever seen werewolves transform.
Yes.
But I love you bringing up the idea of the portals or different, what you might consider more paranormal explanations, because I actually met someone who claimed they were a werewolf, and they had a very cool origin story of how it happened. I mean, this person was so gung-ho that they lived with their pack in a house. Of course, he was the alpha, and a few of the others, that they didn't even have doors on their bedrooms because they wanted to live like they were in a pack. And he truly believed he was a werewolf and would never let me see him transform, of course, but told me that one day he was at a bar and some mysterious gentleman sat across the table from him and said, you know, if you drink this vial, you're going to turn into a werewolf. Be very careful. I'm giving you this chance, this choice. For whatever reason, why this person was picked, he had no idea. But he said after a lot of deliberating on it, he drank the potion and sure enough, could transform into a werewolf, and believed it without doubt that he had been a werewolf. But when it came to proving it, you know, he didn't want to or couldn't. You take your pick.
Well, I suppose as well, we've got to deal with the fact that that is a medical condition, Chad. When we look back to the ancient Greeks, you know, we've got lycan, we've got lycanthropy. The lunacy comes from that type of genealogy in regards to the words. And so these are well established. Obviously, there was lots of reports in the Middle Ages in Europe of people who believed they were werewolves as well. So it's less surprising to encounter somebody who believes that than not, to be honest.
Really is. And we can't discount the genetic disorder of hypertrichosis, which those afflicted with it usually grow hair on their face, long hair on the neck and upper torso. These would often be put as freaks of nature on the circus and carnival sideshows. But again, just because someone has a lot of hair, it would be hard to confuse them as an 8-foot, 450-pound thing moving about. That just because you grow hair doesn't affect your size whatsoever. But always fascinated by those looking to put the werewolf or the dogman into separate categories of they must have supernatural origins, that they're not from this time or they're not from this dimension or this type of existence. And I think really over the years, if you read a lot of Linda's books, you can see her progression from going from this probably as a flesh and blood undiscovered animal to something else is going on here.
Mm.
To the point where she would tell me that she thought there was a portal out near Bray Road on a gentleman's farm, and that these things were entering and exiting through that portal somehow.
Mm.
That they had more supernatural abilities to it, that they could take carcasses from game trail cams without appearing on the trail cam, or other supernatural benefits to them. So if you read carefully from her, you know, Beast of Bray Road through Real Wolfmen to American Monsters to Monsters Among Us, the Michigan Dogman, all of her books, you can kind of see this progression to her opening up to maybe it's not just simply an undiscovered being or animal, much like we would think of a bear or a moose, but one that's undiscovered that is here in the way we think it's here.
Yeah. That gentleman's farm, is it Lee something? I've forgotten his surname.
Yeah, Lee Hampel.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some of that trail cam footage with the strange mists appearing, and was it a deer that suddenly disappears off one of them?
Yeah, he has all this fantastic video. Now, whether it's going to sway you or not, it's very compelling and interesting that these mists would show up and then a deer carcass would be gone from the trail cam. And this, again, was a gentleman who lived out there, wasn't particularly interested in it, but weird things started happening. And he's an older gentleman getting up there and would just start putting trail cams for his own amusement. Like, what's going on? Why are these things happening? And then, you know, Linda started working with him, and now others have been camped out at his property looking for something. They're calling it really the Skinwalker Ranch of the Wisconsin here. They're trying to attribute other things. But yeah, he has a ton of videos and photos of weird things happening. And that's where Linda believed that portals were out in there, or something akin to that. I don't want to put words in her mouth now that she's no longer here, but if you read her books, you'll see how she's shifted. And I think a lot of us in the field that have been doing it for quite some time have shifted to the possibility that these are not just strictly flesh and blood creatures in the way we would think they would be. At least I've shifted that way quite a bit. You know, I'm still open to the possibility that there's some undiscovered species we just haven't found yet. But there's so many weird cases where they're doing things that no known animal can do. And the fact that the world's getting smaller every single day, if they are existing in these pockets of the unknown, those pockets are shrinking every single day.
I suppose as well, Chad, you'll probably come across this as well. As we were talking about creatures coming to the floor over the last sort of 20 years, skinwalkers are one of those things that I think 25 years ago, unless anybody had an interest in tribal lore and Native American histories, they would probably not be aware of it outside of perhaps Skinwalker Ranch. Do you think, once again, people are saying, oh, well, what people are seeing are skinwalkers, which, even with my limited knowledge of the tribal nations in North America, I wasn't aware that the Navajo were in Wisconsin, Chad. Is that something that's just people who don't understand it trying to, once again, as we say about skeptics, explaining everything away? You've got certain believers who think that every one of these encounters must be a skinwalker, even though there's no tribal history to support that.
Not only that, if you dig into the skinwalker myths and legend and folklore, again, just a quick glance at the literature, you'll see that they're entirely different types of beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, mistaking it would be very difficult. And I think sometimes we just think, well, it's probably a Native American legend, not knowing, you know, the hundreds of tribes and the different legends. We just throw it into one camp. But yeah, I think, as you know, you've had guests on talking about skinwalkers, that you'd be hard pressed again to see a skinwalker and think that's a werewolf. You know, skinwalkers are mostly shapeshifting witches of sorts that. Yes. Whether they put on a pelt or a special skin of an animal and can take on attributes of that animal. But again, you think of that as mostly southwestern portion of the United States. And what I find fascinating about Dogman, not to get off topic of skinwalkers, is that while skinwalkers, Wendigo, Kushtika, the fairy folk, many of these creatures of unknown origin have this hesitation to mention them. That if you're down on any tribal land in the southwest of the U.S., do not mention skinwalkers. You will not get a great response. The same is with your, if you're with many cultures in the north, mentioning a Wendigo. You're not going to get open arms, and because they fear these creatures, even mentioning them. In some cultures, even thinking about them, especially dreaming about them, is horrible. But with the Dogman, there's nothing surrounding that. In fact, I think people are more than happy to talk about Dogman sightings. So I think that's fascinating, too, is that with a lot of these things, it's hush, hush. Don't mention it, because once you put it on the radar will come looking for you type thing, that they know you know type thing. So it's hush, hush. Don't mention it, because you'll draw it forward. But with Dogman, doesn't seem to be the case, at least in a lot of non-Indigenous cultures.
Thankfully, it would seem, Chad, because otherwise we're both in trouble.
I mentioned that, especially with the Wendigo, where so many places are just hesitant even to say its name. And I always mention that fact at my presentations when I'm speaking on mysterious creatures, but I mention it usually after the fifth time of me mentioning the name. But, you know, for me, I'm long gone, knock on wood. I've already got too many curses, but maybe some of your listeners don't want to live as dangerously, so they might not want to say it. But I find it fascinating that the mere thought of some of these things is enough, whether to bring them alive, whether they're a tulpa or something similar to that. And I'm fascinated by those kind of theories, that can mentioning something actually increase the chances of you encountering it? That's fascinating.
Yeah. I know when we've been looking at some of the reports that are coming out over here, one of the strange things about a lot of the areas that people are having these strange encounters, Chad, is that they're based on Viking occupation of Northern England. And obviously the Vikings and their nations that supported that, a lot of them would use what were called berserkers. And some of these berserkers, a lot of them were bear-skinned wearers, but a lot of them also believed that they were wolf wearers. And there's a lot of names in this particular area that hark back to the older names for dogs or wolves, even though wolves have been out of the United Kingdom, I think, for at least 600-700 years. So I think there are these aspects of it that, because a lot of Norse culture here has kind of just been left until sort of the last 50 years, we know next to nothing about what their beliefs were in this particular area, Chad. So that could then lend, some would suggest, that perhaps what people are seeing is actually the ghosts of Viking warriors rather than a creature of flesh and blood.
We're doing a lot of paranormal archaeology in sorts because of so much history and so many folklore beliefs and tales have been lost to history, that we're trying to piece those together from what we do have. And I think sometimes the explanations for some of these things might be something we've never even dreamed of, that we're trying to piece these puzzles together with half the puzzle missing. And I think that's the most frustrating part for me, is that I felt like, why couldn't 200 years ago somebody be documenting these cases? Where were the folklorists back then? Well, they were too busy trying to survive and not die.
Yes.
That's what they were doing. So I really wish that some of these would have been better documented. And sometimes they get into folklore. For with the Dogman, one of the most cited cases was back in 1887, where these lumberjacks encountered dogs or wolves running through the woods, and they trapped one weird dog wolf thing in a hollow tree, and when it came out, it was a man. And the story's been told over and over and over and over. Well, the problem is, it was the Wexford County story. The problem is, nobody's ever found that article. Nobody's ever found the documentation that it actually happened. And I think that's what you alluded to earlier when you were talking about the DJ in Michigan, Steve Cook.
Yes.
In 1987, when he came out with this song, The Legend, that talk about the Dog Man, he did it as an April Fool's joke, like kind of a fun little ruse, and wasn't quite expecting the phone lines to start lighting up with people who had experienced the similar thing to what he had basically written the song all fictionalized about. So sometimes we get these stories that they live in folklore, but did they actually happen? I don't know. never, if any of your listeners have documentation of the Wexford County lumberjack sighting actually occurring, I would love to see it, because I've scoured all the newspaper archives, old history books, everything, and never found it in writing anywhere. Of course, it could have just been an oral tale passed from generation to generation as well.
Mm. I suppose one of the other interesting aspects of all this, Chad, as well, is that if you look at the south of the US, then obviously you've got another couple of states that have a history of werewolves, which is the Lugaroo and the Rougarou, depending on who you ask and where they are. And so for me, I've always found the fact that you've got some stories in the south of the US that have been well established for 200-300 years, and yet really Dogman's a pretty new player in the field of strange creatures, really, even though we're now uncovering more and more historical reports and newspaper stories and articles about sightings that obviously predate Linda's work and discoveries of some of these things. So that itself shows you that it depends where you are, that you've still got people who would have these beliefs regardless. And you know, they're very strange traditions about, you know, you're a Lugaroo for 100 days, and if you tell somebody you're a Lugaroo, then they get cursed and all this. And it's a very interesting balance between these two kinds of creatures who are very different. And yet, as we were saying earlier on, where does the line between a dogman and a werewolf stop?
Very completely. That I think sometimes we focus so much on finding differences of what a werewolf might be in dogman, where, you know, does the dogman have more human-like arms or like dog-like fingers? A pause, if you will, rather than, you know, werewolf, which seems to be just, you know, the man-sized a wolf. And oftentimes we find that these places are popping up more and more, where today a lot of people think of werewolves as being in the land between the lakes, which is a national recreation area, the LBL between Kentucky and Tennessee. Places where there's not a long history of werewolf activity, but yet that seems to be a hotbed of where these things are popping up. So yeah, there's no rhyme or reason. There's no documents pointing us to why these things happen. It just seems to be a hodgepodge of sightings, which maybe that's the whole purpose behind it. I'm not sure.
Absolutely. It's keeping us on our toes, wherever's happening, because every time you think you might have got to the bottom of something, somebody else pops up somewhere, like you're saying, because the land between the lakes. I know some people are thinking it's contentious to some would be an understatement, Chad.
Yes, and we've talked about this on previous shows where I've been on with you, that in the old days when you had, let's say, a carload of witnesses that spotted something, you would obviously split them up, have them all draw and write about what they had seen separately, so there's no cross-contamination, no influencing and whatsoever. And back in the old days, it was, if their stories did not line up 100%, they weren't telling the truth then, because if somebody's seeing this and someone else is not seeing the exact same thing, we looked at it as discrediting the sighting. But I think that's changed, thankfully, over the years, that you could have four people in a vehicle and something runs in front of them and they might see four different things or four things differently.
Mm.
And it's still very credible, but they're all perceiving it in a different way. And I don't think that lessens the accuracy of their report or whether the credibility of it. I think that's just something that happens with these cases, that I don't know if they're projecting themselves or whatever different, or we're perceiving them different, or they're changing over the decades. But that happens quite a bit.
Hmm. I suppose I think one of the final points I want to look at, Chad, is obviously Linda sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And her reputation and her diligence and her wonderful ability to make people feel at ease. I mean, she was a guest on here twice, and it was like I'd known her all my life, Chad. She had such a wonderful way with people. And I think in 20, 30 years ago, people might have been concerned that Linda's body of work would be left behind and there wouldn't be anybody picking up the baton. Do you think that because of her influence as a writer and an investigator and a researcher, that she's inspired more people to continue her work and carry it forwards in the same way that she did? Because, as I say, she had a wonderful way with people to make them so relaxed that they, they felt that they could be as honest as possible, as we were referring to about how strange is strange, that she didn't dismiss anything out of hand. She just let people tell their stories, and then she took it forwards.
I've seen it firsthand. For about 2 decades, Linda would present at a conference I would have in my hometown of Eau Claire. And people would come up. I mean, this goes back to when she was using overhead's projector.
Yes.
With and I was using a slide projector. That was the new technology of the time. So that's how far that goes back.
Yeah.
She was using overheads. And people would come up to her. And because she had this unassuming presence about her, this warm welcome, she almost felt like a school teacher because she was at one time, that people just felt a sense that they could trust her and open up to her. And I think partly it was the fact that versus today, she looked like nothing you'd see on TV. She didn't look like she was wearing a costume, cosplaying. She didn't have a weird nickname. She didn't need subtitles under her words to understand what she was saying. You know, so people really took her with a lot of trust. And I saw it firsthand over and over that after we would do these conferences, all the speakers and others would go out to a restaurant or a bar and grill. And people, because they were so well attended in that, that people would come up that would see her out after and want to tell her a story that they didn't get to tell her at the conference. And she'd be just overrun with people wanting to share stories. And she'd always give the time and always took them, you know, with the respect. Whether or not she believed the stories, that was beside the point. She was going to show the respect to these people, and that people had this, she had this uncanny knack of getting people to open up to her and tell stories where they've held on to it for 20, 30, 40 years sometimes and didn't tell a soul because they didn't think anyone would believe them or trust the people. But Linda had that ability or gift, if you will, to make people feel comfortable.
She certainly did. She certainly did. And she's sorely missed even to this day. But I think, thankfully, like I said, I said this many years ago, that one of the main reasons I bought a Kindle back in the day, Chad, was because you couldn't get Linda's books over here for less than £50 a piece. Thankfully, it just, I was thinking to myself before we started the interview and before I dropped you a line, it made me chuckle, Chad, when I'm thinking about it. It seems like a million years ago. But it's probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, that finding one of Linda's books was like finding diamond in the rough. They were so hard to get hold of here in the UK. So I ended up biting the bullet, because I love a physical book. And we get hold of anything. But it was one of the driving forces of me to get a Kindle so I could get copies of her books, because they were so hard to find here. And I think if you look at how far that's gone in the last 15 years, that now you can get everything that Linda wrote in a physical copy, it shows that her reputation and her legacy is going to stay with us forever. And thank goodness.
To your question of, you know, did she influence people? I see that every technique saying, oh, I got into this by reading Beast of Bray Road, or I met Linda at this conference and she inspired me. And that's doubly true with women.
Yes.
Because remember, Linda, now it seems kind of normal for younger generations to think women have always been in the paranormal. And even though there's still a vast minority in the general field, when Linda started out, that was insanely true. So I think a lot of women were inspired by her, but also just people that were inspired that you could do this research in a very academic way, still make it entertaining, still respectful of the witness, and make a career out of it. I think she influenced a ton of not only researchers, but the general public as well. And again, I saw that just by the people that would come up and tell her what her work meant to her. And I think that provided her in her last days, when she knew she was very sick and close to the end, I think talking with her family, that it provided her comfort and solace in knowing that her work would live on. I mean, what greater tribute than all of us could wish for than something we've done influencing future generations? I don't know if there's a better thing to think of it in your last days. So, yeah, I think she had a huge impact, and death has only brought that to a bigger audience.
Yeah, yeah. I know Zelia Edgar is a prime example of that, Chad, that I think Zelia went to one of her lectures when she was 10 or 11 and asked a question. And then Linda spent half an hour afterwards, the presentation, talking with her about things. I mean, that alone just shows you, because you look at how Zelia's work's gone on since then. We'd have lost another brilliant new researcher. Yes, not only a woman in this particular field, but also somebody who is a fantastically entertaining, diligent, and excellent researcher, all thanks to that meeting with Linda.
Yeah, and the butterfly effect of that, or the accumulation of that being passed, I mean, how many people have Zelia now influenced? And it goes on and on and on and on. And not only was she an open ear for the general public, but I can't tell you how many researchers in this field talk to Linda about things that they would just call her out of the blue, and she wouldn't know them from Adam, and just spend time with them and become friends with them and have a multi-year friendship. So, yeah, it was a glue that would really hold the field together in some regard.
Yeah. She was an absolute diamond, and as I said, she'll be sorely missed, but we've got a wonderful body of work, and like you say, the influence that she's had beyond the realms of cryptozoology can't be understated, I think, and long may that butterfly effect continue.
I agree, yes.
So, Chad, before I let you leave, my friend, what's happening with you as a man that's usually got many a plate spinning? What projects are you working on? Where have you been trying to take Joe to have him curse himself again?
Yes, my never-ending goal of getting Joe Turi off of this planet one way or the other. No, I've got stuff. Kevin Nelson and I have been doing a lot of follow-up Wendigo research, stuff we didn't get to before our book came out, and stuff we're discovering now after. So that's been taking up a lot of time. And like you and everyone else in this field, I've got dozens of things going. It's just a matter of time to get to them all. But for me, 2024 is going to be a big year. I've got some cool stuff, and hopefully still have a little free time to hobo my way around the country as well.
So you got many conferences lined up?
On average, I do roughly 150 to 200 lectures a year throughout, for the general public, at universities, libraries, historical societies, you name it, corporate functions. So that's always a source of great enjoyment, but also a source of really good new material. Because as I mentioned earlier, that it's the general public. It's people that probably haven't talked about this kind of stuff. They haven't contacted researchers. So, but they just want to tell somebody about it. So that's really where a lot of my new stuff and new research arenas come from.
Excellent. Well, I know that there's a couple of irons in the fire, Chad, that I am extremely excited about one particular project you're working on, but we'll not say much about that. I know there's been a few interesting photos shared that have got people excited, so I am looking forward to that particular project. So where can everybody find your work, get hold of some of your books, and keep up to date with everything you've got going on?
Easiest way, if you want to contact me, tell me a story, what be it, is just ChadLewisResearch.com. Everything you want or don't want is there.
Brilliant. Well, Chad, for your ninth appearance, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure spending time in your company. Thank you for your time and your conversation, as always. You're always so generous and considerate when you fit me into your hectic schedule. So thank you, as always, my friend, and I look forward to your 10th appearance, no doubt, down the line.
Keep an eye on my mailbox for that sport coat, the velvet one, coming. I'm a size medium, so send it any color would do. Thank you so much.